As a real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Their teams apply local insights and global perspectives to help identify the most compelling investing opportunities. Principal Asset Management, actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors LLC.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Joe Weisenthal.
And I'm Tracy Alloway.
So, Tracy, we have a lot of anniversaries coming up in terms of major financial news and events in financial history.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have, let's see, the 10-year anniversary of the 2008 financial crisis. That's next year. But even more importantly, I think we have the 30th anniversary of the movie Wall Street coming up in December. That's the one I'm the most excited about.
That's the real that's the big one.
Yeah, I know.
I think we may have talked about it before, but I'm kind of dreading the next 2 years and hearing everyone, including many of our colleagues, just endlessly recant war stories about, I was there the day this bank went bankrupt, and here's the thing I wrote, or whatever. It's like, we're going to have 2 straight years of that.
Joe, I'm going to love it, and I'm going to force you to sit through an entire Odd Lots episode where I just talk about September 2008.
All the great coverage you did during that time.
Yeah, exactly.
But besides the movie Wall Street and besides the financial crisis, we are at another really important 30-year anniversary. And, of course, that is the 30-year anniversary of the Black Monday crash in 1987.
Ooh, has it been 30 years already?
Can you believe that?
We are old.
We are old. You know, we think in our history is like, okay, there was this crash, the stock market fell a lot in a very short period of time, and then the stock market recovered, and then we kind of move on. But I think you would agree that there is a lot of fascinating stuff to unpack from this experience in terms of what it tells us about how markets work and how traders work and all kinds of stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. People have been drawing lots of parallels to Black Monday recently, and I'm sure we can get into that later. But more importantly, I think there's a tendency as we get further and further away from these events to kind of forget about what a big deal they actually were at the time. And Black Monday in particular was huge for markets and led to some regulatory reform. But when you contrast it with what happened in 2008, it kind of seems like there was a fairly quick rebound. But, you know, the actual day, the actual event was just huge and full of drama. Not that I was there, but...
No, but from what we understand, I don't recall it either. And not too much of a side. I was 7 years old at the time, but I don't remember it in the news. I mean, I was kind of aware of some stuff. Do you remember it?
No, I was even younger. I thought you were going to tell me that you were trading futures at the time.
No.
Or Euro dollars or something. Okay.
I was not. Anyway, I'm very excited about today's episode because we are going to be talking about someone who, unlike us, lived through Black Monday. He was an active trader. He still is active, but he was active during the crash. And he's known for having made crucial trades the day after that performed very well. So I don't think, I think we're going to get a very rare perspective on this event today.
This sounds amazing. I want to hear all the anecdotes.
Me too. So without further ado, I want to bring in Blair Hall. He was the founder of Hall Trading Company in 1985, so just a couple of years before Black Monday. He's still active in proprietary trading. He has a firm called Ketchum Trading. He even has an ETF that's based on his market timing. And he's featured in Black Monday Revisited, an oral history of the crash. It's put together by Richard Dewey. It's running in this month's issue of Bloomberg Markets Magazine. It's really awesome. Amazing oral history piece. Also features Peter Borish, Michael Lewis, Jim Chanos, Nassim Taleb. Gotta check it out. So pretty much the perfect person to talk to about this historical episode, Blair Hall, thank you very much for joining the Odd Lots podcast.
Sure. It's good to be with you, Joe.
Tell us, first of all, I'm curious, what did you make of our intro? Do you think we characterized the events of 1987, or we basically sort of framed its historical context well? And can you tell us what you were doing at that time, career-wise and professionally, leading up to this big event?
Well, at first, I think it is an important time. First of all, the 87 crash was caused by some factors that we now know about. And as a result, we have made some market reforms that I think will reduce the probability of a catastrophic event in financial markets, and as a result, volatility will be less in the future. But it was a very crazy time. What happened is the market had gone through was down 5% the previous week, and then it was down on Monday, and everybody knew that it would be down again on Tuesday, but we didn't know to what an extent it would be down. And there was an event called in portfolio insurance, or there was an activity called portfolio insurance that really exacerbated the crash and caused this extreme movement all in just a couple days.
Wait. We're going to dig into all of that. But before we do, what were you doing before 1987?
Well, I was a market maker. Actually, I had been a blackjack player before then. I was a card counter in Las Vegas. I had bought a seat on the Pacific Stock Exchange. And then I had built a firm that had about 20 employees that were making markets in index options and futures and stocks. And so we had a presence on most of the major exchanges at that time. So, and one of the things we had is a screen that would automatically provide option quotes. We were one of the first people to automate the process of creating quotes as an options market maker. And I was on the Chicago Board of Options Exchange in the SPX pit, which had just been created. So that morning, Tuesday morning, that's where I was at that time with as part of a firm. We had a firm of about 20 people at that time.
So from what I remember, options were booming in the 1980s, right? And that was partially off the back of the creation of Black-Scholes or the discovery of Black-Scholes. Can you kind of walk us through what that market looked like, you know, the day before Black Monday or Black Tuesday happened?
Well, the Chicago Board of Options Exchange was the largest exchange at that time, although the American Stock Exchange existed along with the Pacific and Philadelphia. We were trading calls and puts on the S&P 500 in a pit, in open outcry at that time.
Blair, there's so many things that I want to ask you, but I feel like I'm going to forget to ask you about this if I don't do it right now. But just briefly, tell us a little bit about the skill overlap between going from being a blackjack card counter to a stock trader. We talk about gambling a lot in various ways on this podcast, but I'd love to hear it from your perspective. What specifically is the skill set that sort of transcends both things?
Well, there are two skills, really. One is dealing with risk and capital fluctuations. That's one skill. And then the second skill is working with a team. I was part of a team playing blackjack in Las Vegas. And so both of those skills, first of all, the capital fluctuations. Even though you have an advantage in any kind of a game or a marketplace, you will have capital fluctuations and capital drawdowns you will go through bad periods. But you have to understand that you do have an edge in the long run and have faith in that. And you have to be able to withstand those losses and stay in there and keep operating in a rational and objective way throughout that time. So it's emotional. It's really learning to deal with your emotions is part of it. And the other part is that you need to be able to work with other people in a collaborative way. And that skill, of course, is very important also.
And is this so that in the context of blackjack, so that the casinos don't recognize you as a card counter?
Being recognized is another issue completely.
No, that
wouldn't be. It's just in terms of just working in a team. People that do significant things collaborate with others.
Got it.
So Joe always brings it back to either gambling or chess, usually. But just to stick to the theme, I mean, there is a link between gambling in Vegas, say, and Black Scholes and Black Monday, right? Like, people talk about the Kelly Criterion and Ed Thorpe and Merton Scholes. Can you kind of square that for us or give us the background?
I always say it's getting an edge and staying in the game. Staying in the game is knowing how much money to put on the table at any one time. And if you lose half your bankroll or half your trading account, you must reduce your size of your positions by half. And so that relates to the Kelly criteria of knowing how much to capital to put at risk at any one time and being able to adjust that as your capital either increases or decreases.
Right, let's go back to the events of Black Monday. So one thing I realized we didn't say is that how bad Black Monday was. If for people not familiar with it, the Dow fell over 20% in one day. Absolutely.
508 points, famously.
Which, you know, these days may not be that much or kind of, you know, a volatile day. But just an absolutely extraordinary one-day sell-off, the likes of which financial markets had really not seen before on such a grand scale. There's also crashes all around the world. But let's go to that Tuesday. So walk us through the event. Obviously, everybody completely fried or stunned by the events of the day before. Tell us about how you were thinking going into the markets that Tuesday morning and how people were behaving.
Well, we had screens that actually displayed our prices in the SPX pit at the Chicago Board of Options Exchange. And so these were prices that you allegedly could trade on. And in today's market, you can trade on them. In those days, they were representative quotes. And so we gave our best estimate of where volatility was. And I don't have the exact numbers here, but I think we were guessing that volatility would have risen from something like 20 to 40. But when implied volatility opened at 60, it was, as the lead market maker in the SPX pit, we were essentially run over by orders. We could not respond fast enough to these, move our markets fast enough to even stay somewhat in the game. It was an extremely stressful time where everybody was fighting to get any kind of protection they could on the downside.
So an open outcry pit, people are physically trading, right? Were you doing the hand signals and all of that?
Oh, it's voice and hand signals, yes, both.
So what was the atmosphere like then on that day?
When there's an extreme move either way, there is usually there were a lot of people in the pits. And when I alluded to, I think earlier we talked about how later in the week, as actually people were so scared and the Fed had increased capital requirements, we actually had there were fewer people in the pits later in the week. But that morning it was extremely chaotic and nobody knew what was going to happen.
So what did markets do in the early hours of that Tuesday? And then what did you do in particular to sort of, spot an opportunity in the chaos? And why did you sense that there was an opportunity then?
What happened is the market actually rallied Tuesday morning, but then it continued to sell off. And we suspect that was because of the portfolio insurance orders that had not been executed from the previous day. So the market had a steady decline. At that time, the Chicago Board of Trade had a contract called the Major Market Index, and we were one of the larger market makers trading across index products. So we had positions in the New York Stock Exchange Index on the NYA, and we had a position in the OEX and the SPX and we also had a position in the Major Market Index at the Board of Trade, which was a mirror of the Dow average. So it was included 20 stocks, 20 large stocks. We had positions all across the board and had to keep track of whether we were trying to stay neutral relative to the marketplace. But the reason that I had to go over to the Major Market Index was that there were no brokers in the pit that could execute our orders, because the Chicago Mercantile and the Board of Trade had said you must have at least $100,000 in your account as a broker to execute orders for other people, and as a result, many brokers were excluded from participating, and there was no broker, outside broker, that could trade for us. Normally, we went through a broker in that pit, but I happened to have the full Board of Trade seat, and so I could go over and personally trade. So even though I was the head of the firm at that time and would not normally be doing trading in one of those futures pits, I did walk across the street from the CBOE to the Board of Trade.
You jumped in. But this is what I want to ask, because in the 2008 financial crisis, one of the accusations thrown at some of the big market makers was that they just stopped picking up their phone and taking orders. Was there any of that on Black Tuesday? I realize some people couldn't trade because they didn't have enough capital, but did anyone just kind of throw their hands up and walk away and say, this is too much?
Yes, essentially, the specialists in New York were not picking up the phone. In Chicago, there was a pit, so there were those people that were there, and some of them would be quiet, and others would open their mouth. One of the things I actually learned from a colleague over at the Chicago Board of Options Exchange by the name of John Stafford, we had traded together, and one of the things that he did is he said that when somebody comes in with an order, you always respond to them, even if you can figure out what the price should be, because these are complicated options trades and futures trades. Mm-hmm. But you always respond to them. It may be with a ridiculous price, with an extremely wide market, but you always respond. So I was in the mode of always responding to, which sometimes can get you into trouble, but in this case, it worked to my advantage.
As a leading real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Our experienced teams are uniquely positioned to uncover compelling opportunities in today's market, giving our clients an exclusive advantage. Principal Asset Management, actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors, LLC.
Fill in the details there in terms of how it worked to your advantage. You had this opportunity of essentially being the only person in this position that you were in. How did things then sort of settle out for you in the days and weeks ahead?
Well, that first of all, the key was that morning when the market continued to decline. And, of course, it looked like it was never going to end. And so what I did was that I was in the major market pit, and I had been a small buyer trying to reduce our short position. So I was buying five small lots of twos and threes and fours and fives to try to reduce our position. But there was a rumor that they were going to halt trading on the Chicago Mercantile in the futures contract. That was the big contract. And so if they halted that, I was fearful that they would halt for a couple days even. So I actually sent, I actually asked somebody from the firm to go over to the library and do research to determine what happens on trading halts. Now, this was a completely ridiculous request because we obviously didn't have time. We only had about 20 people in the firm. We didn't have time to send somebody over to the library. And in those days, we didn't have Google. I had a sense that if they were going to halt trading, that this was a buying opportunity because the panic had gone too far. And so I told the firm to be long on the halt. So we were acquiring a position at all at this time. Well, it ends up that Drexel Burnham, of course, a firm that doesn't longer exist, had a seller who was selling his position, and they needed to sell this position. I guess the client had said, we need to sell it. They knew that it was a very orderly pit, and one of the things that happened was that Pat Arbor, who was chairman of the Board of Trade at that time, did not get enough credit for actually keeping that market open the entire time. And it was a very orderly market with about, no more than 20 participants. I wish he should have gotten more credit for not panicking and closing the markets. So as things started to decline, Drexel Burnham had a big order to sell. And knowing that I had been probably the only buyer in the pit, a consistent buyer, they said, where will you buy 100? And I gave them a ridiculous price. And they said, you own them. I was scared to death, had a big lump in my throat, and immediately told the firm that we were long 100 contracts. It was an extremely large trade. I think one of the things is the market was trading in extremely wide increments. It had normally traded in 5 and 10 cent increments. So it was trading about 290. It would have been 290 and 5 cents at 10 cents. In this case, it was 290 at 295, and there was there were bids at 290. He actually, because it was a large contract, he said, I'll sell them at 285. So I bought these contracts at 285. Trades 287, trades 288, and he says, then I'll sell you another 50 at 285. I bought them and considered sharing some of those contracts with the rest of the pit, and by the time anything had happened, it was trading. It was 290 bid, it was 295 bid, and later in the day, I think it finished somewhere in the 360s, 360, 370.
So it seems so simple in retrospect that you kind of stayed calm and started buying when other people were really panicking and selling. What was it that you saw that other people like Drexel didn't? Or what was it about your position that allowed you to do that but prevented them from doing a similar thing?
Well, I was providing liquidity, so they were forcing the market. I did have a sense. I did know that I didn't know, but I had a sense that a trading halt provided an opportunity. So that was the reason that I provided liquidity on that side, especially, and it was also in conjunction with the fact that the Feds had raised margins. So we then also had to reduce positions. So I was in the right place at the right time, with some sense that this was an opportunity.
So we have to just about wrap it up here, but I have one very quick question, one slightly longer question. The first question is, can you tell us, you know, how much in the end your firm made from this trade? But more importantly, as we look at the market now and people worry about whether we see things like the echoes of portfolio insurance reemerging and other sort of volatility products and so forth, what do you think are the key things to understand about the vulnerabilities of market structure today?
Well, I think in retrospect, I actually do know Mark Rubenstein, who was the creator of portfolio insurance. And actually, I have a house in California. And he was at a party at my house after the crash. Must have been early November. And he was so sad. He was distraught. He said, I caused the crash. Later, even though it wasn't well known at that time, it was, in fact, true that the crash was exacerbated by portfolio insurance, which now, today, with the liquidity that is in the market, is probably a very viable product. he was distraught. He's a very honorable man. And he, along with, was Hayne Leland and John O'Brien, they were the founders of Portfolio Insurance. But now, with the circuit breakers and the tremendous liquidity that is provided by proprietary traders, I think portfolio insurance now is a viable product where it wasn't at that time.
So it's just too ahead of the time.
Blair, can I just press this issue? Because a number of people have brought up parallels to portfolio insurance. So, for instance, the risk parity strategies that kind of assume a relationship between bonds and equities, various types of programmatic trading, sometimes even volatility trading. Do you see any parallels between, you know, a potential Black Monday, Black Tuesday situation and some of those more modern strategies?
I haven't thought about this to a large extent, but I don't think there's, I mean, at that time, this was a tremendous, there was a tremendous amount of money in this strategy relative to the liquidity that could have been provided. I think there are more diverse strategies now. A risk parity is can be adjusted over periods of time that have to do with the volatility of each instrument. And so as a result, those adjustments occur on a more gradual basis. I don't see one strategy that is overwhelming the others. And so with the circuit breakers that we have in place, I think that's and the market structure has caused really this decline in volatility. We're at historic lows in volatility. I find it interesting the press that says that, you know, we're in crazy times. We're not. We're in a very stable times from a volatility standpoint at this point in time.
From our perspective in the press, we might even say it's too stable. We need more interesting stories. Blair Hall is fascinating to talk to. Great to get your perspective. Love hearing the stories of, you know, the sort of different era of trading. Really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
So, Tracy, I love hearing about sort of different eras of trading and what it was like. And so, obviously, crashes and huge crashes can happen at any time, and there'll be big ones again in our future. But thinking about things like being the only person physically in the room or having to go to the library and look up how the rules of a trading halt could theoretically affect markets, that's distinct to a certain time. And it's sort of like, you know, I find it very interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was really sad that little bit, that anecdote about Mark Rubenstein going to the party and saying that he caused the crash. Because, of course, the whole idea about portfolio insurance was that you protect yourself in times of crash. So poor guy, kind of. You know, one thought that struck me. Some things are the same when it comes to trading, like the notion of some market makers just panicking and not picking up their phones. That happened, you know, in 2008. But I wonder if there's one thing that's different now, and that's the sort of regulation and legal aspect of everything. Like, I just wonder if you really had the market falling apart, how many compliance people are you going to have descending on your market making or maybe even prop trading units or teams telling you that you can't, in all honesty, do anything because you just don't know what's going on and you have an obligation to your shareholders or clients? I just wonder if that's the thing that's going to change this time around.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that lesson, that sort of trading lesson here relayed about, you know, if you don't know what to do, don't say you don't know what to do, don't not answer the phone, just go out there with a ridiculous quote. So just, in other words, give yourself a huge margin of error to be wrong. And if the client, if the person on the other end of the trade doesn't want to take it because they think that's a ridiculous quote, then okay, they don't have to. But if they do take it, then you give yourself the opportunity to make a, you know, you put the choice back on them, but you give yourself an opportunity to potentially make a lot of money. Just seems like one of those like interesting ideas about how in a period of extreme volatility or extreme moves, you can sort of protect yourself in that way. Continue your obligation as a trader, as a market maker, but give yourself, you know, that cushion.
But again, you have to have a lot of autonomy and a lot of confidence to do that. And I wonder if that's kind of what's lacking in modern finance. I guess we'll find out the next time we have a flash crash or Black Friday or Black Monday or Black Tuesday or Black any day of the week type event.
And there will definitely be those days. And hopefully we're still doing our podcast by the time the next one comes so we can talk about it.
Yeah, and we'll actually be there and we'll have war stories of our own to tell.
Exactly. This has been another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Joe Wiesenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart.
And I'm Tracy Alloway. I'm on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And you can follow our producer, Sarah Patterson, on Twitter at Sarah Pat with two T's. Thanks for listening. Hey there, it's Joe Wiesenthal.
And Tracy Alloway.
And we are the co-hosts of the Odd Lots podcast. And we want to tell you about a new podcast here at Bloomberg we're really excited about. Money Stuff, the podcast.
That's right. Friend of the pod, Matt Levine, is teaming up with our other friend and Bloomberg TV host, Katie Greifeld, to bring the Money Stuff newsletter to life. Every Friday, Matt and Katie will dive into all the Wall Street finance and other things that make Matt's newsletter such a hit.
You can listen to Money Stuff the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.